Chapter 13. Sensing. The Sutta. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects, in terms of these six internal and external bases. And how does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind objects as mind objects, in terms of these six internal and external bases? Here, a bhikkhu understands the eye, he understands forms, and he understands the fetter that arises dependent on both. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen fetter, and how there comes to be the abandoning of the arisen fetter, and how there comes to be the future non-arising of the abandoned fetter. He understands the ear. He understands sounds. He understands the nose. He understands odours. He understands the tongue. He understands flavours. He understands the body. He understands tangibles. He understands the mind. He understands mind objects. And he understands the fetter that arises dependent on both. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen fetter, and how there comes to be the abandoning of the arisen fetter, and how there comes to be the future non-arising of the abandoned fetter. Like any other phenomenon, consciousness owes its arising to conditions and passes away when those conditions disperse or change. In the Kamaloka, the realm of sensuous desire, consciousness cannot arise without some kind of physical basis, in our case the human body. This combination of mind and body, known in Buddhism as Nama-rupa, which, as we have seen, is an abbreviated version of the five khandhas, appears among the 12 links of dependent origination on the Tibetan Wheel of Life in the form of a boat with four passengers, one of whom, the one representing the mind, is steering. Further round the wheel, in dependence upon name and form, come these six sense bases, represented by a house with five windows and a door. Appropriately, because these six senses are the six ways in which external phenomena enter or impinge upon our awareness. Consciousness is not fixed, but changes from moment to moment as the sense organs, including the mind, meet their objects. Sight consciousness, for example, arises when the external object impinges upon the eye, and that object is brought into the field of visual awareness. Then, when a different object comes into view, a new mode of sight consciousness arises. It is this interaction between internal and external sense bases, combining again and again, that brings about a continuous flow of awareness. Buddhism calls these internal and external factors of sense experience the 12 ayatanas. Since we have six sense bases and six kinds of object, sight, hearing and so on, including the mind, the forms of consciousnesses that arise when they meet are also of six kinds. Add these six kinds of consciousness to the 12 ayatanas, and you get what are known collectively as the 18 dhatus. They give us a closer analysis of experience than the hindrances or even the khandhas, and through them we can become aware of how mental states emerge into consciousness time and time again. In the case of the root negative mental states, greed, hatred and delusion, they emerge in the form of what are known, tellingly, as fetters, the various kinds of habitual and reactive behaviour that prevent us from being able to experience consciousness in its pure form. The act of sensing is in itself quite innocent. The mere fact that you happen to see something or think of something has no karmic repercussions. What is karmically significant is the state of consciousness that arises in dependence on that sensory contact. For instance, when you look at a flower, there is no craving present in that simple looking. But it may be that in dependence upon the sight of the flower, you develop a craving to pick it, to possess it, to make it your own. This state of consciousness arising in dependence upon the sensory event defiles that pure awareness, and thus begins sensual desire. But this chain of events is not inevitable. Indeed, the aim of the contemplation of these six sense bases and their objects is to prevent the arising of that unskillful mental state, to leave a pristine, non-deluded consciousness of reality. This state of pure awareness might seem a long way from our everyday experience, but it does sometimes happen that we are able to be aware of things in this way, at least briefly. At the end of a session of meditation, when you have just opened your eyes, you might be content just to sit for a moment before your mind starts to tick over and desires take hold. Or you might sometimes look at nature with a comparatively innocent eye, not wanting to make use of what you see, or even take a photograph, but appreciating it for its own sake. But it is only when one has entered upon the path of transcendental insight that this state of mind becomes a regular feature of life. A Hindu yogini once suggested to me that the pleasure one experiences upon attaining the object of one's desire is produced not, as it might appear, by the obtaining of the object, but by the fact that, for a moment at least, desire has ceased to operate, and you are no longer looking outside yourself for contentment. If you have satisfied your hunger by eating an enjoyable meal, for example, you might be able to look at a lovely bunch of grapes with no desire to eat even one. At that moment, with your appetite satisfied for the time being, desire has all but disappeared from consciousness, and you can for once look at something without wanting anything from what you see. But until you have obtained insight, such purity of awareness can only be a temporary respite. It will only be a matter of time before you will start to look at those grapes with a different eye, because after all, it would be such a pity to waste them. However, the fact that we have occasional moments of freedom when the power of craving has been attenuated and we can look at things in comparative innocence shows that there can be sensuous enjoyment without sensual desire. There is nothing wrong with seeing and hearing, with the sense organ coming into contact with the sense objects, nor indeed with the feeling that arises in dependence upon that contact. It is only when craving, or one of the other fetters, arises in dependence upon feeling that our problems start, and also where the solution to those problems is to be found. At the very beginning of the sutta, we learnt that the bhikkhu abides having put away covetousness and grief for the world, and the laconic conjunction of these two makes the nature of the problem plain. Suffering is the inevitable fruit of craving. It is in our actions, whether of thought, word or deed, that we are skillful or unskillful, not in what we experience. It is how we go about choosing our experience that determines the ethical weight of any situation in which we become involved. It is when we want a bit more out of our sense experience than the sense experience itself that we get into trouble. In the Udana, the verses of uplift, the Buddha gives exactly this teaching to the mendicant Bahiya. Quote, "Then, Bahiya, thus you must train yourself. In the seen there will be just the seen, in the heard just the heard, in the imagined just the imagined, and in the cognized just the cognized. Thus you will have no thereby." In other words, if you see something, just see. Don't read anything into the experience, just see what is there. In the same way, just hear, just touch, just taste, just smell, just imagine. If thought is needed, go ahead and think. But think and have done with it. Don't wander off along the way. And if you become aware that you have wandered off, don't make a drama out of it. Let the critical moment of awareness be what it is, no more and no less. The moment of awareness is a time to be aware, not a time to speculate about the whys and wherefores of the situation. Give up the mental commentary, the ego-based interpreting thereby. Just see, just think. It sounds simple enough, but if you have ever tried to achieve such mental clarity, you will know exactly how difficult it is. Once it is accomplished, the awareness created is like a mirror, reflecting everything without distortion. Crucially, however, and this is what makes it so difficult, it should not be cold like a mirror. It should be not an alienated awareness that stands back from its objects, coolly looking on without really experiencing them. It is a truly unfettered consciousness, known in the Vajrayana tradition as the wisdom of Akshobhya, the imperturbable, deep blue Buddha of the five Buddha mandala. His mirror-like wisdom is not a cold, hard surface from which experience bounces away, but a deeply responsive awareness which has no need to force its own views onto what arises in its depths. This pure, unadulterated experience is like that of the skilled musician immersed in a beautiful symphony. If he were to linger in playing any of the music to savour and enjoy it more, the music would be ruined. Yet that is what we so often want to do. We won't let the music continue. We want to play one little passage again and again, refusing to let the symphony of life go on. But if we could be a living mirror or echo, happy to appreciate phenomena just as they are, we would be content simply to experience and let go. The Buddha spoke of the mental states that hold us back from that pure awareness as fetters. He probably didn't have a particular list of fetters in mind when he gave this teaching. The Satipatthana Sutta does not list them all, and indeed there is no single definitive list in use throughout the Buddhist tradition. But one example is the list of 10 fetters put forward by the Abhidharma, which includes belief in a fixed self, doubt about the truth, attachment to rules and rituals as ends in themselves, hatred, various kinds of desire, conceit, restlessness, and ignorance. Any of these fetters will tend to arise whenever an external sense base impinges upon one or more of the corresponding internal bases. Ideally, one would learn to exercise such vigilance that the fetters didn't have a chance to get a grip, but would be broken very quickly. But this is much easier said than done. One can suppress the hindrances temporarily in meditation, but to break the fetters once and for all, one has to develop insight. The overlap between the hindrances and the fetters, sensual desire, doubt, restlessness, and ill will appear in both formulations, indicates that the two groups of negative mental states are not distinct classifications. Various groupings of positive states overlap similarly. Indeed, all the groups of mental objects, from the hindrances to the Four Noble Truths, consider the same states of consciousness from different angles. The fetters and the hindrances, in particular, are two ways of understanding what are basically the same drives, the difference between them being a matter of the breadth of one's perspective. If you are trying to overcome the hindrances, the aim is the practical one of absorbed meditation, while the attempt to break the fetters is made with the aim of attaining insight. You eradicate the hindrances temporarily every time you attain states of dhyana in meditation. When sensual desire arises as a hindrance, for example, you can put it into kind of temporary suspension in order to concentrate and unify your mind. But this doesn't conduce directly to insight, as it would if the corresponding fetter had been broken. The potential for the hindrance is still there, and it could still re-emerge into consciousness in any situation in which the internal and external sense bases come together. Both the fetters and the hindrances are cyclical in nature. They will come round again and again, in dependence on the particular ways in which you habitually seek satisfaction. You might perhaps hear a sound in the kitchen, and in dependence from this, the thought of food might enter your mind, swiftly followed by a memory of some sweet taste. Before you know it, through sheer force of habit, you are beginning to hanker for something to eat. The fetter of sensual desire has arisen, due to the hearing faculty, in a sense, but it is not really the sound that made it arise. The chief conditioning factor was the accumulated force of your own karma, resulting from having given what is called unwise attention to sense objects in the past. Perhaps you have always greedily enjoyed eating sweet things, so that your mind continually looks for an opportunity to have that sensation again. This is where the development of awareness comes in. When you have become aware that this is happening, you can file away at that fetter just a little more before it disappears again out of your conscious awareness. The metaphor of the fetter is rather misleading. A single decisive moment of mindfulness will not be sufficient to break a fetter. The fetters are deeply entrenched in our psychophysical makeup, not to be broken without continuous and long-term application of mindfulness. Sensual desire, like the other fetters, is an extension of the body's functions, inherited from the lower evolution. It is written into the very fabric of body and mind. If you are hungry, you might start searching for something to eat, without even being aware that you are doing so. You have the drive of sensual desire because you have a body, and the body is itself the product of your karma, your past habitual action. Through the deep-seated will to be, you have provided yourself, in the form of your present body, with the means of giving expression to all those fetters, including the belief in a separate self that underpins them. We cannot look back to a time when we were free of the fetters. It is sometimes considered that children are innocent. In modern times, ideas of impurity and immorality have tended to be associated almost exclusively with sexuality, and in that sense, children are innocent. They are also innocent in the eyes of the law, which does not hold them responsible for their actions. But interestingly, the more we are socially conditioned to think of children as innocent, the more they seem to become selfish little monsters. Innocence is not something we have lost to be rediscovered. The fetters are there from the beginning. They are beginningless, self-renewing, and thus potentially endless. The aim of spiritual practice is to redirect this cyclic flow of semi-conscious volitions. By bringing awareness into the fetters as they arise from sense contact, we send the energies involved in them onto a more creative path, thus adding a fresh dimension to our experience, like a three-dimensional spiral emerging out of a two-dimensional circle. Every time we break out of the cycle of reactivity, every time we choose not to turn in upon ourselves in a reflex of greed or cynicism, ill will or restlessness, we are opening up to a new way of being, or in other words, embarking on what is often called the spiral path. And every time we fail to make this creative shift away from unreflective habitual action, we reinforce the fetters and reduce the strength of our will to break free of them. Spiritual practice is always a decisive act. Conversely, the fetters, being the product of the whole cyclical mode of reactive consciousness, are perpetuated by our just going along with the flow. This is the anguish of the ghost of Jacob Marley, who, in Dickens' A Christmas Carol, appears before Scrooge fettered by a terrible chain and curdles his former business partner's blood with a fearful admission. "I wear the chain I forged in life. I made it link by link and yard by yard. I girded it on of my own free will, and of my own free will I wore it. Is its pattern strange to you?" Maintaining enough vigilance to stop the perpetual reforging of the fetters is very demanding, at least at first. But if you sustain that directed effort, in the end, it is sure to bring about the arising of transcendental insight. If the doors of perception were cleansed, says Blake, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. When in the seen there is only the seen, consciousness ultimately opens out into a non-dual awareness. When your vision is as clear as this, you see impermanence not as something marked off in steps and stages, the impermanence of particular things, but as an unbounded, unbroken flow, so that you have no need to hang on to an idea of an unchanging sense of self to connect all these supposed fragments together. This goal of seeing everything as infinite can seem alienating, as if one is supposed to become something one isn't, or even no one at all. But the reality is simpler. When the doors of perception are cleansed, you perceive more clearly and brightly than ever before, though it is difficult to say what you see and realize. Through the practice of mindfulness, as the obscurations to perfect vision are progressively removed, insight begins to unfold of its own accord. The first stage in this process culminates in the point of entering the stream, what is also known as the opening of the Dharma eye. According to the Pali texts, there are 10 fetters holding us back from perfect insight, and one enters the stream when the first 3 of these have been worn so thin that they finally break. These 3 fetters are belief in a fixed self, doubt about the truth, and attachment to moral rules and rituals as ends in themselves. And each of them has to be removed before we can make any real progress. The fact that they are all broken together at the point of stream entry suggests that they are, in a way, one and the same fetter, viewed from different angles. They certainly share a characteristic that marks them out from the other fetters. They are each intellectual, that is, they consist essentially in an attitude of mind. However much we have to take into account their emotional underpinning, they each consist, ostensibly, in an explicit view, a consciously formulated attitude. They represent the way we usually look at things on the conscious level, and can thus be addressed and seen through in conceptual intellectual terms, hence the usefulness of developing the ability to pursue directed thought. One might object that our view of the self as unchanging is based on emotions rather than being an intellectual conviction, but this view is still amenable to intellectual examination. We have already considered the impermanence of the physical body in connection with the cemetery contemplations. A dead body changes very quickly indeed. Nor does death provide the sole evidence for physical impermanence. Just standing regularly on the bathroom scales will show that your body changes from week to week, and changes in others are even more perceptible, especially when you haven't seen someone for a while. However, even though most people will be prepared to admit, albeit reluctantly, to being physically impermanent, they will still claim to find something unchanging amid this ceaseless bodily and mental change. This is what is meant by the belief in a fixed self or ego identity. To know something, indeed to know anything, seems naturally to call for a knower as well as something that is known. But the Buddhist position runs counter to this intuitive knowledge. It asks us to note what we observe in our actual experience from moment to moment, and then ask ourselves whether we can really deduce from the stream of sense impressions alone the presence of a permanent self that has all these experiences. Obviously, this is a question to which a negative answer is expected. According to Buddhist philosophy, all we can say with certainty is that consciousness exists. The unchanging self or soul that is supposedly the source of that consciousness is something we have added on, an illusion produced by the very activity of dualistic thinking. It is our belief in its existence that ultimately holds us back from insight into the nature of things as they really are. And if we can convince ourselves through our own observation that this self is an illusion, the fetter will be broken. the fetter of doubt will also eventually give way under the pressure of clear understanding, close observation, and sustained reflection. It is not thinking the wrong thoughts or asking awkward questions that constitutes the kind of doubt meant here. Doubt binds us as a fetter when we do not investigate those thoughts and questions deeply enough, but take up an inflexible attitude of scepticism and indecision. As for the third fetter, reliance on rites and rituals as ends in themselves, this is, in a sense, at the opposite pole from doubt. It is a fidelity to one's practice that is not questioned enough. It is not the observances and rituals themselves that bind us. They are an essential support for spiritual practice. The fetter consists in simply going through the motions of religious activity, but forgetting its true purpose. The more you consider your experience in the light of the doctrines and practices taught by the Buddha, the clearer a sense you will get of what freedom from these fetters might mean. This is what is called by the Buddhist tradition right view. With further practice, as you put more and more energy into the whole process, backing it up with meditation, that understanding will eventually produce a decisive change of direction in the whole current of your being. From that point onwards, it is impossible to fall back. Once you have made this decisive break with the cycle of death and rebirth, a breakthrough which the Buddhist tradition calls stream entry, you are no longer a victim, dominated by and trapped in these deeply rooted tendencies, and you can expect to be reborn in the human realm no more than 7 times before the attainment of complete enlightenment. Although the breaking of the first three fetters calls for particular effort on the intellectual level, you can break them only if the whole of you is involved. Reason and emotion are not separate. Challenging your most cherished assumptions about the nature of things and looking deeply into your habits of mind calls for a strongly positive emotional drive. Insight cannot be achieved by rational means alone. You are attempting to shift the basis of your entire life, and to do this demands a powerful and positive, even joyful, emotional commitment. The fetter of dependence on rules and ritual observances as ends in themselves, for example, is more than just a superficial approach to ritual practices. It is a lack of wholeheartedness throughout your spiritual life, a holding back from total involvement, a reluctance to bring your deeper emotions into play, a lazy wish to believe that going through the motions will be enough to see you through. The first three fetters are called intellectual, in part by way of contrast with the remaining 7, which are more clearly emotional, involving as they do deep-seated attitudes that make them even less accessible to conscious transformation. The next phase in this gradual process of awakening involves breaking the fetters of sensuous desire and ill will, both of which persist in subtle forms even beyond stream entry. And one has to be a considerable way along the transcendental path before one becomes free of the fetter of bhava-tanha, the desire for continuing existence. We have a natural urge to go on living. Even someone who is very ill may cling to life, although there is no pleasure in it. Bhava-tanha means you want to exist on whatever terms are possible. It runs very deep in us, and indeed continues to be present in consciousness well beyond stream entry. It manifests particularly in the dhyanas. At those refined levels of meditation, one's experience is so satisfying that one will be quite happy for that state to carry on forever. Desire for such refined states is a positive thing, but attachment to them becomes a fetter because you have ceased to look beyond them towards transcendental insight. This happens on a more subtle level still in relation to immaterial existence, in the even more sublime state called the Arupaloka, and it happens until such time as the 7th fetter is broken. As one gets deeper into meditation, the variety of subtle mental impressions, hitherto overlooked, begins to stand out more clearly, and very subtle forms of the fetters become apparent. The fetter of restlessness, for example. It may be experienced in a subtle form as a mental sensation which troubles you even when your meditation is apparently going very well. You might be quite deeply absorbed, and then, for no apparent reason, the idea might suddenly arise that you should end the meditation and get back to mundane consciousness, even if you have no need to do so. Or perhaps a breeze begins to blow outside, and although your meditation is becoming more concentrated, the thought, "It's going to be a windy night," arises in your mind. There might be no craving present, no hatred, no sloth or torpor, but still a thought will just quietly float into the mind as a slight anxiety, a subtle failure of confidence, a wisp of self-concern. Restlessness arises from deep within the psyche. On the threshold of enlightenment, it is obviously not merely a psychological fidgeting. One might call it a sort of oscillation between the most subtle mundane experience and the transcendental, a last flicker of attachment to the conditioned. If it seems strange that this hindrance should recur so far up the spiral path, we can remind ourselves that these lists and categories are not to be taken too literally. Doubt, for instance, is listed as one of the first three fetters to be broken, and certainly a substantial degree of sceptical doubt, the willful indecisiveness that stops us from entering on the transcendental path, disappears at stream entry. But even when such doubt is out of the way, there is still the possibility of doubt arising with regard to that which, for the time being, lies beyond one's own experience. At any stage you can entertain doubt with regard to what a higher stage might be like, and what you have to do to get there. You might even wonder whether there is a higher stage at all. You might think you have got as far as it is possible to go, a doubt which is clearly linked to the fetter of desire for continued existence in the realm of immaterial form. Thus, even though doubt is one of the first three fetters to be broken, you cannot abolish it conclusively until you have abolished ignorance, the very last fetter to be broken, according to the Pali commentaries. In other words, only an Arhant or a Buddha is absolutely free of the fetter of doubt, inasmuch as you do not have actual knowledge of the transcendental, because it is beyond your present experience. You are to that extent ignorant, and where there is ignorance, there must be at least a degree of doubt. Indeed, one might even say that ignorance is the only fetter, and that all the others are different aspects of it. All the fetters, gross and subtle, imply the continued presence of the conception of a separate self, the self-view eliminated when the first three fetters are broken, is only a relatively gross form of that mental attitude, which recurs in subtler forms in the fetters that are broken at more advanced stages of development. Conceit, the idea of oneself as being in some way comparable to other people, whether as superior, inferior, or equal, is the most obvious example, but even this is not the subtlest self-view of all. Dualistic consciousness is what splits our experience into me and the world, and this, according to the Buddhist analysis, is our fundamental mistake. Subject and object arise in dependence on each other. There is no continuity of an unchanging person. The ego, with its likes and dislikes, views and opinions, is a self-perpetuating illusion, arising in dependence on our previous actions, our ingrained habits of consciousness. But although in reality there is no separation between subject and object, we are unable to plunge into that realization because of the mind-made fetters that hold us back. Herein lies the importance of contemplating these six sense bases and their objects. When the internal sense base comes into contact with the external object, if you give very careful attention to what happens as a result, you will in the end come to see how the mind fabricates from that interaction a self and a world, unable to stay open to the ever-changing flux of things. "Humankind cannot bear very much reality," said T.S. Eliot, "but we can learn to bear it. Indeed, it is the wellspring of freedom and joy, if we train ourselves to see it steadily and see it whole." The Buddha's last words, we are told, were "appamadena sampadetha." In other words, with mindfulness, strive. Appamada is a kind of zeal that never lets a single opportunity go by. A keenness to get on with the things that really matter, in the knowledge that there is no time to waste. If you mean to attain stream entry in this lifetime, everything of which you become conscious is significant, and you cannot afford to let it slip past. Conditions change continuously, and as they change, any of the fetters, or a combination of fetters, is likely to get a grip on us. We have to strive constantly to be aware of whether our responses to input through the six senses, including the mind, are conducive to freedom or to bondage, whether our efforts, or lack of them, are making the fetters stronger or weaker, and whether or not our states of consciousness are conducive to our ultimate liberation. If you go for a walk, you have to be aware of the thousands of impressions that come crowding in on you and know just what effect they are having on you. And you have to keep this up from instant to instant, minute to minute, hour to hour, all day and every day throughout the weeks, months and years. There can be no holiday, no time out from mindfulness. You have to be ever vigilant. And you must be vigilant, not because any authority tells you you must, but because the price of slackening off, an endless succession of rebirths in the six realms of existence, is simply not worth paying.